It's hard to purge someone from your heart when you can see a child you love in their features. Anne didn't bring her new life with her, apart from the baby inside her, which she reassured and soothed with a hand rolled across her belly. The silence between us terrified me. "Where's your little boy?" I said.
"Nanny,"
she said, and she made it sound like a destination. I followed her into the loft, fascinated by that single strand of silver in her hair. Not because it confirmed she was getting older, and she would one day be old, something that had never crossed my mind before now, but because I knew she would lose the special shine I had fallen in love with when we were kids. The shine was always going to go, and it wouldn't have made any difference. I would have kept on loving her without the special shine of youth. Maybe I would have truly loved her for the first time, but of course now I would never get the chance.
"Don't look at me like that, Max. It's giving me the creeps."
"Sorry." Scout and Stan came out of her bedroom. We all stared at our visitor as if she had come from some other planet and not just down the road in London's leafy money belt. Then Anne was on her knees and all over Scout. "That's the trouble with not seeing much of your child. Acting naturally around them becomes impossible," and I felt a flood of resentment that I could taste in my mouth. "Scout should have mattered to you. Scout should have mattered to you more than anything." Stan mooched towards Anne, tail high and swishing. He sniffed hopefully at her legs, and she stood up, one hand at the base of her spine, the other fanning the air, her lovely aging face twisted down with distaste.
"I don't do dogs," she said. "You never know where their mouth has been."
I picked Stan up and took him to Scout's bedroom. He gave me a mournful look as I closed the door. When I got back, Scout was showing Anne the junior boxing gloves I had bought her. In truth, Scout had shown zero interest in putting on boxing gloves. She preferred drawing or hanging out with Stan or talking to her dolls. Scout insisted she was not playing with them, just talking. But I could see that she felt some nameless compulsion to show her mother something new, so that this time she might stay. They talked, mother and daughter. I went into the kitchen and I was in the middle of making coffee when a great wave of grief rolled over me and sucked me down. The feeling gripped my throat and stung my eyes and made me feel that I would never move again. Then it was gone. I went back into the main room with a tray, two coffees and an orange juice.
"I'm not drinking caffeine anymore," Anne said. I was confused, but she loved her coffee.
"I'll get water," I said.
"Don't push the boat out on my account," she said, and that made me laugh.
She could always make me laugh.
"Do you want to see my drawings?" Scout said.
"Yes," Anne's hand rolling over her belly. "Yes, Scout, yes." Scout went to her room to get her drawings. Anne and I looked at each other. I could see the effort she was making. We turned our faces to the sound of Scout's voice. Stan was making an unsuccessful attempt to escape.
"No, Stan,"
Scout told him, closing the door behind her as she went into her room.
"Dogs," Anne said. "Boxing."
She made it sound as though I was running a crack den. Anne moved slowly around the loft, as if checking to see if she had left anything of importance behind, and stepped on a stuffed monkey that gave an outraged squeak.
"There's junk all over the floor," she said, "and it's not even Scout's junk."
It was true. Stan had his own junk. A dog of that age is exactly like a toddler. Stan had junk scattered all over our flat. A squeaky duck, a spiky rubber ball, a bear in a Union Jack bib, assorted bits of chewed bone and gnawed rope.
"And this is really your dog?" she continued, with the amused contempt that I remembered so well. "You're not looking after it for somebody?"
"Dogs are great," I said. Stan was back, having escaped from the bedroom when Scout came out with her drawings, and he shot me a furtive glance.
"Dogs don't care if you're rich or poor," I said. "Dogs don't care if you're beautiful or plain, smart or dumb, or what kind of car you drive."
"That's right," Anne said.
because dogs are stupid.
What's that strange smell?
Scrambled omelette,
Scout said, placing a stack of drawings before her mother.
Daddy burned the pan.
Scrambled omelette, Anne said. There's no such thing.
No, scrambled omelettes are good,
Scout said, and I nearly wept at her loyalty to my simple meals.
Because you can have what you want in them, ham, cheese, and you can eat them with Paul Newman's barbecue sauce.
Anne touched her hair and laughed.
Darling, there's omelette and then there's scrambled eggs. There's not scrambled omelette.
Scout was wide-eyed.
Lots of great chefs are men, she said.
Anne shook her head, smiling. She studied the top drawing.
What's this one? This one's from school, Scout said.
She carefully read the title.
My Family.
Anne inhaled.
But there's only you, Daddy, and the dog, darling. Where's Mummy and your baby brother? Where's Oliver?
The new man. At least you didn't call him Uncle Oliver, I thought. At least we are spared that ugly fate.
I've got more drawings, Scout said, before Anne could complain any more, and she went back to her bedroom.
Look, Anne said to me, if you're finding it difficult to adjust... I stared at her. I didn't know what to say. Adjusting is getting on with it, the same as adjusting. A burst of sudden pain throbbed in my lower back.
What's wrong with you? She said. Daddy's not at work today, Scout said, her arms full of drawings. He hurt his back.
How long has your back been bad, Max? I'm fine, I said.
Are you sleeping?
Like a baby.
What?
You wake up wet and screaming in the middle of the night. We smiled at each other.
I'm going to be the grumpy sheep, Scout announced, dumping her drawings on the floor.
The grumpy sheep? Anne said. What's that?
The sheep that didn't want to see Jesus. The story's called The Grumpy Sheep. The part I play is The Grumpy Sheep. It's in the Bible.
Scout's nativity play, I said, at Christmas. I'm not sure The Grumpy Sheep is in the Bible, Angel.
Daddy's going to make my costume.
Anne raised an eyebrow. Good luck with that, she said. It was time to go. There were promises to see Scout soon, promises to come again, promises to have her down and put her up and show her a good time, talk of baby brother and unborn sister that meant nothing to Scout. Promises, promises. If they were kept, then everything would be better, not perfect, not remade, but better. And, despite everything that had happened, I knew that Anne loved Scout, but she hadn't made space for her in the new life with a new man in the new place. And unless and until she did, Scout would be lost to her, and our beautiful daughter would carry those wounds with her forever.
Oh, Anne said, there was a young woman waiting for you downstairs.
I get that a lot, I said.
I can believe it, Anne said, walking away from us, back to her new family, her new life. They probably like your dog.
Hello, Sick Note, Wren said. I thought you were never going to let me in. What's wrong with you now?
Torn internal intercostal muscles, I said.
Wren shook her head. You're going to have to give me a clue.
The intercostal muscles lift your rib cage when you inhale and exhale.
Does it hurt?
Only when I breathe.
We missed you at Mallory's funeral. It would have been good if you were there, Max. His wife, Margaret, she was asking after you.
I hung my head and choked something down. I can't see her, I said. I wouldn't know what to say.
You don't have to say anything, stupid.
Scout and Stan came out to meet her.
His hair is the same colour as mine, Wren told Scout.
All three of them were delighted. Stan began hopping around. Wren offered him the back of her hand to sniff before she started stroking him, and I could tell she was raised around dogs.
What's your name? Scout asked.
Edie,
Wren replied.
Look at this, Edie, Scout said, and then to Stan. Play dead.
Stan flopped down on his side, his head lifted from the ground, his eyes wide open and fixed on the Nature's Menu chicken treats gripped in Scout's little fist.
He licked his lips. His head quivered with anticipation. In truth, he didn't look very dead. He didn't even look sleepy.
That is incredible, Ren said. Never seen anything like it. The pair of you should be on TV, whatever that show's called. Well done.
Beaming with pride, Scout and Stan went off to her room.
When are you coming back? Ren said.
Tomorrow, I said, maybe the day after.
It doesn't matter, because this would be off the book.
There was an A4-sized file in her hand, small and thin and green. She held it out to me, but I made no attempt to take it.
Mispers, Ren said.
What?
I was looking for missing persons, remember? Missing girls from 20 years ago?
A glint in her eye.
You asked me, remember?
I nearly laughed out loud. A spasm of pain shot through my lower back. It's over, I said. Case closed. Murders solved. The perp convicted. They got their killer, didn't they? Ian Peck, a.k.a. Bob the Butcher, was standing up for all the murders, not just Mallory. Not just the one he actually did, but also the murders of Hugo Buck, Adam Jones and Guy Piggy Phillips. Peck was an official serial killer, a superstar of real-life crime. Bob the Butcher's followers were still lighting up the social network sites. I suddenly felt somewhere beyond exhausted. I heard Whitestone made DCI, I said.
That's right, Ren said, and she deserves it.
And they're giving Mallory a posthumous QPM.
And Scarlet Bush has got a book out called Pig Slayer.
A book? Already?
Pig Slayer is an e-book, Grandad.
She flicked her fingers.
They do 'em fast. Haven't read it myself. The Chief Super's happy. Looks like everybody in our team is going up at least one pay grade, while you're at home with your busted back feeling sorry for yourself.
I shook my head. It's over, I repeated.
No, Ren said. It's only just starting, because there are still the missing.
You know how many people go missing in this country, I said. Every single day of the year.
Yes, Ren said. One every 3 minutes, most of them young, many of them female. Girls running away from care homes, girls who are being abused by dear old mum's brand new boyfriend, girls with drug problems, drink problems and body issues, self-harmers and addicts of every kind, the waifs and strays, the unlucky ones who fall through the net, who fall through all the nets. Girls who are pregnant, girls who think they're in love, girls whose parents are religious fanatics, who think they are whores if they listen to pop music.
That just about covers it, I said.
You know how many girls went missing in the country that year, 1988, the year we're looking at?
I was silent for a moment. I guess it was a lot, I said.
You wouldn't believe how many.
And you're going to find them all, are you, Edie? Avenge them all, make it right.
Not all of them. Just one. I narrowed it right down. The net you gave me was much too wide. It turned up too many names, too many missing girls, so I looked in the immediate vicinity of Potter's Field during school time in the spring and summer of 1988.
But not all Mispers are murder victims, Edie. Some of them, most of them, are just lost contacts. You heard of lost contacts? Did you do lost contacts yet in detective school?
Fine, she began to gather up the contents of her thin little file. I'll do it by myself.
Mispers are sometimes just lost contacts who got out and moved on and changed their name and were bloody happy to get away from whatever nightmare they were stuck in, I said.
That's true, she conceded, but some Mispers end up dead in a basement, or alive, and that's even worse, alive in some bastard's basement for 10 years or more, chained naked to some fucking wall, and you know that's true too, don't you, Max?
I was silent for a moment. Yes, I said.
And you were there. You heard what James Sutcliffe told us. There was a girl, Max. It all starts with a girl. Find the girl and you find the killer and you find the motive for it all. But first, you have to find the girl. And we have to find the girl, don't we? We can't just leave her.
She stared at me.
You really want me to do this thing alone, Max? I can't believe it. I don't think that's who you are.
You don't know me.
Probably not.
I walked her to the door. You know the worst thing about being on your own with a kid? I said. You care a lot less about the rest of the world. You really wouldn't believe how much less you care. You just do. Your heart gets hardened. Your world narrows down to you and your child. You want to do this thing off the book? She nodded. But why? I said. The missing will still be missing. Mallory will still be dead. Bob the Butcher will still be getting marriage proposals sent to his cell.
We do it because if we don't, they get away with it, Ren said. We do it because if we don't, we're just like the worst of our kind, too scared to do our job, and we do it because it matters. We do it because it's right.
The file slapped hard against my chest. This time I took it.
You have a daughter, Max, Ren said. Do it for her.
When Mrs. Murphy arrived, I went down to Smith's of Smithfield to look at the file. There wasn't much in it. 3 sheets of paper. The first featured a passport-sized photograph of a fair-haired girl in her mid-teens holding an uncertain smile for the camera. A name, Anya Bauer. German? And a date of birth, 4th of July, 1973. I looked at the photograph and saw that Anya Bauer had teased her hair into some elaborate approximation of some unknown hero. It could have been anything from a pop star to a princess. It could have been Madonna or Princess Diana. No, it was Madonna, early on, when Madonna's hair was still quite short. Anya Bauer, trying to look older, trying to look pretty, trying to do what every teenager in the world tried to do. Anya Bauer was in her mid-teens in the late 80s, so she would be on the cusp of middle age by now, if she had lived. The second page was a printout from a contemporary missing persons website with the same photograph and a disclaimer. Note, the child may look significantly different now to these images due to the age and stylistic differences. The third and final sheet carried the same image of the smiling girl. Page 7 of the Potter's Field Post, dated 21st of August, 1988. One sentence. Anya Bauer, 15, has been missing from her home for 2 months and police are anxious to contact her. And there was a telephone number that had probably been defunct for the best part of 2 decades. I looked at Anya Bauer's photograph for a long time. And when I climbed the stairs to my home, just before I opened the door, I heard the sound of Stan barking and the untouched joy of Scout's laughter. Chapter 28. Welcome to Potter's Field, said the ornate wooden sign on the edge of town. Final resting place of the royal dogs. Wren snorted. They make it sound like the Taj Mahal or Victoria Falls, she said. It's not even all the royal dogs, is it? Just Henry's. They haven't got any of the Queen's corgis in there, have they? And probably not all of Henry's dogs. The sign featured the Henry VIII of popular imagination. The portly wife killer in his middle years, not the athletic young king whose statue adorned the school he had founded 500 years ago. Some goggle-eyed spaniels frolicked by his silken club-toe shoes. They all looked like Stan's relatives. It was always a shock to see that there was a town beyond the world of the school. Like a lot of small English towns, Potter's Field hovered somewhere between gentility and poverty. With Wren at the wheel of a pool car, a little unmarked Hyundai, we passed a pretty village green where a group of local youths sat drinking from cans and smoking, their mountain bikes scattered around them.
DCI Mallory's wife came in, Wren said, after the medal ceremony. Margaret. She was really nice. She wanted to thank everyone. She's a class act, that lady. She was asking after you.
A pause.
You should go and see her.
You want to take the police station or the local newspaper? I said.
Wren stared at me. Did you hear me?
I heard you. Police station or the local rag?
She looked at me for a moment longer, then looked away.
We're on the high street now. There were quaint little tea shops among the chain coffee shops and mobile phone stores and supermarkets. I pulled up outside one of the tea shops. A life-sized effigy of Henry VIII and his dogs guarded the offer of afternoon cream tea and a taste of English summer.
I'll take the local rag, Wren said.
They were not expecting me, but my warrant card got me into an interview room with the duty sergeant, Sergeant Lane, a big, red-faced copper with a hint of a rural accent. He handed me back my warrant card with a smirking mixture of deference and derision, but he shook my hand and gave me a paper cup of scalding black coffee. CID, you're back, he said. We haven't seen you out here since that unfortunate business with the sportsmaster. But the perpetrator went down, didn't he?
This is another matter, I said. A missing person.
I slid the thin file across the table. You've always worked in Potter's Field.
Born and bred here, he said. The big city never appealed. It's beautiful out here, very green. You get out in the fields, it's like the last few centuries never happened.
Do you remember a missing person called Anya Bauer?
He was half-heartedly leafing through the file.
And why would I? He said. He closed the file and raised his eyebrows.
Not much of a missing person, was she? More of a lost contact.
The file slid back towards me.
So, she was reported missing, but you never followed it up, I said.
A slow smile.
You think we've got plenty of time on our hands? The local yokels?
I smiled back at him.
Not at all. You must get busy. All those spoilt rich kids at Potter's Field.
Oh, they're no trouble, he said, bridling. We have a good relationship with the school, always have done.
If those kids are smashing up restaurants, then they're doing it in Chelsea and Knightsbridge, not round here.
He gestured at the file. Foreign girl, was she?
I nodded. German, from Munich.
Would you have tried a bit harder to find her if she'd been a local?
He laughed.
Wouldn't have had a choice, would we?
Then his face grew serious.
Have you got a body?
Is that what this is about?
We don't have a body. It's more of a hunch.
I was on my feet, gathering the file with one hand and reaching out to shake his hand with the other. He took it and gripped it for just long enough to demonstrate that despite my age and warrant card and fancy big city ways, he was by far the stronger man.
Forgive me, but I don't quite understand why you're here, he said. This is an official inquiry, is it?
Just some old business we're trying to clear up, I said. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure, he said.
Before I was out of the door, he was reaching for the phone.
The offices of the Potter's Field Post were located on the high street above an antique shop, but Wren had left a text message changing our meet and directing me to a small thatched cottage on the edge of town where a sprightly woman in her early 80s was tending an immaculate garden.
She's inside, she called, with my husband. It's not locked.
An old golden retriever lumbered up to me as I went into the cottage. It sniffed my hand sleepily and then trailed after me down the hall as I followed the sound of Wren's excited voice. She was on her knees in the living room, peering through a magnifying glass at an old contact sheet of photographs. The floor was entirely covered with contact sheets. In an armchair was a white-haired old man with what looked like a large scotch in his hand. The dog went over to him and collapsed on his tartan slippers.
"Be good, Fanta," said the old man, and to me, "Hello, young man. Would you like a wee dram?"
"Single malt," Wren said. 20 years old. It's very good."
There was a glass on the table, but it didn't look as though she had touched it. The old gentleman started to rise from his chair, but I held up my hands, thanking him, but no. Wren pressed the magnifying glass against her eye and then against the contact sheet in her hand.
"There's nothing at the paper," she said. "It's on its last legs. They don't even have proper files. They haven't even digitally converted their old filing system. I found dry rot in their microfiche. Can you believe it?"
"The Potter's Field Post," said the old man. "They give it away these days. Give it away. A free sheet, they call it."
"But they directed me to Mr. Cooper here," Wren said.
"Monty," the old man erupted.
"Monty," agreed Wren. "Monty was the staff photographer on the paper for 40 years.
"Man and boy," he chortled.
I got the impression that Monty mightily enjoyed Wren's company, and was happy to produce his stacks of old contact sheets. He didn't even seem to mind the red felt-tipped pen she was waving around for emphasis and using to circle images of interest. I sat down beside her. "Nightmare at the local rag," she said. "As far as I can tell, they did nothing on Anya Bauer beyond that one piece when she went missing. They never followed it up."
"Neither did the law," I said.
"But look at this," Wren said, and held out the magnifying glass.
"I photographed this town all my working life," Monty said,
and I could hear an even stronger echo of the old, lost countryside that I had heard in Sergeant Lane's voice.
"And once a year, on Potter's Fifth, I photographed the school."
I was looking at images of boys in military uniform. It was a uniform worn by the 7 boys in the combined cadet force of Potter's Field. But here there was an entire army of them, and they marched across the decades.
"Potter's Fifth is the school's big day," Wren explained.
Monty barked with laughter. Fanta, the golden retriever, sat up sharply and then slowly curled itself back into sleep.
"On the 5th of May every year, the school opens its doors to the great unwashed," Monty said, "and the town opens its heart to the school, or pretends it does. It's the Potter's Field equivalent of the 4th of June at Eton. Of course, they've got the river at Eton, and we don't have a river."
"Do you see them?" Wren said.
"No." She punched my arm.
"Jesus, Wolf, look harder."
I saw hundreds of boys in uniform, marching past the statue of the young King Henry, saluting the raising of the flag. Eyes snapped right as they marched past the camera. And then I concentrated on one central image on the contact sheet that was circled with red and the mist cleared. They were not as I remembered them, cocky and grinning and unbreakable, as they had been in that first photograph. Now they were serious, upright, stern, in a line of boy soldiers being inspected by Her Majesty the Queen when she and they were 20 years younger. 7 of them together in a line that stretched beyond the frame of the camera. Guy Phillips, Salman Khan, Ben King, Ned King, James Sutcliffe, Hugo Buck, Adam Jones. And towering by the side of the Queen, as Her Majesty frowned at James Sutcliffe, there was Peregrine War, the line of his mouth suggesting that he was about to detonate with pride.
"And this one," Wren said.
There was another contact sheet she had placed by her side. It too had a red circle around one image. It was night in the picture, a long shot of some kind of party in a large white tent. Waiters hovered with trays of champagne flutes. Parents and boys and masters and guests stood around grinning and swilling. Another Potter's Fifth had gone well. And on the far side of the party, I could see a boy and a girl half turning away from the camera with a smile.
"It's Ben King," I said.
"It's Ned King," Wren said. "Look closer. You can just about see the scars on his face where his brother glassed him over the Cocoa Pops."
"And the girl?"
"She was young, blonde, pretty.
A ponytail bobbing, a shadow of a secret smile as she turned away. She was in t-shirt and jeans, far too casual for an event like the one in the big white tent, far too casual for Potter's Fifth." Wren smiled and shook her head.
"I don't know. It could be just a girl. You talked to Ned King, right? You and Mallory?"
"I remember the night out at Briars Norton, when Captain King and his regiment were about to get on the Hercules for Afghanistan. The killings had only just begun," I said. "Ned King was leaving. Mallory was gentle with him, impressed by him." I stared through the magnifying glass at the image of the boy and girl at a party long ago. We both were.
"Well, someone has to talk to Captain King again," Wren said, "when he gets back."
"Monty," I said, "would that have been your only reason to go to the school, Potter's Fifth?" He nodded and eased himself out of the chair.
"Apart from pictures we needed for the files," he said, "when there was a new headmaster, They would always want a shot of him. And the statue of Henry, the mainstay of our tourist industry.
He was bent over the coffee table, not risking getting down on his knees. And the grave, of course.
The grave of the royal dogs.
He tapped a ragged cardboard file.
There you go.
These were not contact sheets. These were glossy 8x10 shots. Some of them were of the headmasters of Potter's Field, formal portraits. Peregrine Waugh was the most recent. But there were also men long retired, long dead. And there were close-up shots of the grave of the royal dogs, taken in all kinds of weather and all kinds of seasons. I held one in each hand. One was black and white, a stone slick with rain, the grass around it untrimmed. The other was in colour, the stone reflecting a white bar of summer sunshine, the grass border neat and cut. But that wasn't the only difference between the two photographs. Look at the inscription, I said. Look at the epitaph on the grave. I held up the black and white shot. The words are missing on this one. On the photograph of the grave taken in summer, the epitaph was there, but on the rain-slick shot it was missing. The old photographer smiled, and he didn't need to look at the words to recite them.
Brothers and sisters, I bid you beware of giving your heart to a dog to tear.
Well, they could hardly put that on the original grave, now could they?
Why not?
Because the grave is nearly 500 years old, he said. But those words were written in the early 20th century by Rudyard Kipling. By my time, the grave was literally falling to bits, collapsing in on itself.
Wren said, Do you have any pictures?
He looked doubtful, but eventually found one image of a small yellow bulldozer parked next to the cracked tomb. He could clearly make out the name of the company on the side, V.J. Kahn and Sons.
The grave was always unmarked, Monty said, or at least the inscription had worn clean away. I never saw anything on it. It's 500 years old, remember?
But when they restored it, he added the words from Kipling.
Who did? Wren said.
The headmaster, he said, sipping his single malt. Mr. Waugh said he didn't want to leave the grave unmarked.
Chapter 29. I left Wren tucking into cheese on toast with Monty, his wife and their golden retriever, and drove the pool car to Potter's Field. The school seemed shut up and silent already, but the main gates were open, and I left the Hyundai in the staff car park. I could make out a figure moving around in the twilight of the playing fields, and I was starting towards him when I heard the sound of the first shot. A large gauge gun some distance away, the shot seeming to contain its own echo. And then there was silence, and I started off again towards the playing fields. The buildings looking so lifeless that you would never guess they contained 1,000 souls. The old caretaker, Len Zukoff, was moving slowly along a rugby pitch with what looked like a lawnmower. It was only when I got closer that I saw he was leaving a long, straight white line in his wake as he marked out a touchline. I called out a greeting, raising my hand.
Don't step on that, he replied. Still wet.
Remember me? D.C. Wolfe from West End Central. I was reaching for my warrant card, but he couldn't have cared less about my warrant card.
I remember you.
I'm just following up a few details of our ongoing investigation. But he wasn't interested. He was already moving off, his machine drowning my words, the straight white line trailing behind him.
Don't step on my lines, he shouted over his shoulder, a man accustomed to bawling at generations of boys. Got to get this done before dark.
I walked back across the main courtyard, round the side of the college chapel and into the graveyard. There was a flurry of sound and movement. A squirrel skittered across my path and swiftly up a tree. I reached the grave of Henry's dogs as another shot split the silence, and there was the epitaph. Brothers and sisters, I bid you beware of giving your heart to a dog to tear.
Weather and time had etched the words in green moss. I turned at a shuffling sound behind me and saw Len Zhukov coming slowly down the path, checking up on me.
What do you want? He said. You shouldn't be in here. You should tell someone you're coming. Get permission.
Those words on a grave, I said. I never realized until today that they're only 100 years old, but the grave is 500 years old. So they had to be put there within the last century. His mouth moved, as if to say, and so what?
I just wondered how I missed it, I said,
talking to myself as much as him, looking up at the sound of another gunshot. Noticing things, it's sort of what I do, Len. He didn't take his eyes from me. What's that shooting? I said. 12 bore.
Sounds more like a .410, he said. Better for close range. Thick cover shooting. Vermin.
He rubbed his hands on his overalls. They were locked in permanent fists by his arthritis. He saw me looking at his hands and pushed them deep into his pockets.
Rats, rabbit, and fox, he added. Where are you from, Len?
He frowned at me.
I told you. I'm from here, he said. Originally, I mean.
Russia.
Russia? I didn't call you Len over there, I bet.
Lev, he said. Near enough.
What part of Russia?
We both looked up at the sound of another gunshot, closer now. The long, drawn-out, rolling sound of a large-gauge shotgun fired in open countryside. The noise just went on and on.
Who's shooting?
I said. He shrugged. Well, that was another subject he couldn't care less about.
Farmer,
he suggested.
So you came over after the Second World War?
No, he said, not quite smiling. I came over after the Great Patriotic War. I smiled.
Same war, different names.
No, he said, unsmiling.
Very different wars. Very different wars for your people and my people. In Russia, there were 25 million dead.
We both stared at the grave.
I wondered what he thought about an English king who built a tomb for his pet spaniels.
Not much, probably. Not if he had been in Russia during the war. He had to be somewhere in his 70s, I guessed. That would have made him a boy of 11 or 12 at the end.
You must have been too young for the war, I said.
He laughed. Nobody in Russia was too young for the war. I nodded. I'm away now, I said, and offered him my hand to shake. It was a mistake. He took his arthritic hands from his overalls and brushed his clenched right fist briefly against my open palm, and we both turned away with our own private shame. He made no attempt to follow me this time. Perhaps he figured that I wouldn't be able to poke my nose in where it wasn't wanted. Certainly, everywhere seemed locked up, and despite the falling darkness, few lights appeared in any of the ancient windows. I looked up at the room where Mallory and I had stared across the playing fields with Peregrine War, but I could see no sign of life even there. But I saw Len Zhukov again as I walked back to the car park. He was in front of his little stone cottage with another man, and it took me a moment to recognize Sergeant Tom Monk, the burns on his face, a smooth black mask from so far away. As the old caretaker watched, a cigarette clutched in one balled-up fist, Monk raked a pile of newly mown grass, shoveled it into a wheelbarrow, and carried the load round the side of the cottage to where the smoke from a small bonfire was rising, easing the old man's burden. I raised my hand in farewell, but they did not appear to see me. Then there was another gunshot as I reached the car, much closer now, coming from somewhere just beyond the tree line. The stuttering shot tore through leaves and took its time to crack the sky. Len was wrong. Whatever they were killing, they were not using a .410 to do it. I know what a 12-bore shotgun sounds like. That's big vermin someone's hunting, I thought. Happy to get back into the car. There was something wrong with the silence. It jolted me from my shallow sleep And before I was even awake, I was sitting by the side of the bed, staring straight into the eye of the madman who sat on my bedside table. 12:05, he told me, 5 minutes after midnight. Outside, I could hear the hum and roar of the meat market as it began its night. The clamour of the trolleys, the shouts of the men, still laughing with the long hours of the night ahead of them. What had woken me? I pulled on my pants and a pair of lightweight knuckle dusters that sat in the drawer by the bed. They weighed nothing, but would crack open a skull like a boiled egg if you could get close enough. I stepped out of my bedroom, resisting the urge to call Scout's name. Inside his cage, Stan stirred in his sleep. Our front door was shut. Our windows were unbroken. There was no fresh air coming from somewhere it shouldn't be. I looked at Stan's cage. It was not a sound that had broken my sleep. It was the absence of a sound. I knelt beside Stan, felt under him, and beneath the blanket that covered his basket, and pulled out the alarm clock we had put there to stand in place of his mother's heartbeat. The battery had died some time ago. I smiled at him in the darkness and touched his soft red coat. Then I walked into the kitchen and dropped the old alarm clock into the bin. Stan didn't need it anymore. He was home. But under the door to my daughter's bedroom, I could see that Scout still slept with all the lights on. Chapter 30. Salman Khan opened his front door, unshaven and squinting in the pale morning sunlight, a baseball bat in one hand and a cigarette in the other. He held them both loosely, as if either might slip from his hand in a strong wind. He was in a dress shirt open to his waist, with a black bow tie hanging around his neck like fresh roadkill. He looked like he'd been wearing black tie to bed for a week.
"Mr. Khan," Wren said, "DCI Whitestone received a complaint."
"Because they're not here anymore," Khan gestured with his baseball bat. "The officers who were protecting me, the ones who were here after the, what is it, the Osman warning."
Wren smiled sympathetically.
"Because the threat to your life is over," she said, all professional calm. "The perpetrator has been convicted."
He laughed, viciously. We just stared at him, letting the laughter fade and then the silence grow. Khan looked over our shoulders. There was a young Nepalese security guard on the drive. You were starting to see them all across London's money belt. Private policemen hired to watch over just one wealthy street. The rich were getting scared. But nobody was more scared than Salman Khan.
"Thank you, Padam," Khan said.
The Gurkha saluted.
"Sir."
We followed Khan inside his house. A midget motorbike was resting against a double-sided winding staircase. Through glass panels in the marble floor, you could see down into the basement area and the impossible blue world of an indoor swimming pool. You could feel its heat, taste the chlorine. Wren looked at me, and I knew she felt it too. These people have so much.
"Your family are away," I said.
"They can't stay here. It's too dangerous. If anything should happen to them."
This was meant to be routine, one of the last jobs on the action book in the winding up of Operation Fat Boy. But Salman Khan could still smell murder in the air.
"What are you afraid of, Mr. Khan?" I asked.
"Are you serious? Some of my closest friends have died."
He stubbed out his cigarette and immediately lit another one.
"Mr. Khan," I said, "look at me."
He looked at me, looked away, and threw his baseball bat aside with a scream.
"Fuck!"
"How's your father's business doing?"
"A building firm, isn't it?"
It took him a moment to recover.
"My father died 10 years ago. The company was sold at the time of his death. Why do you ask?"
Wren said,
"Who was Anya Bauer?"
The name seemed to mean nothing to him. He shook his head.
"I don't know what's going on," he said. "I don't know what you're talking about. You're supposed to be..."
"What happened at that school?" I said.
"How long are you going to keep asking that question?"
"Until I get the truth,"
What happened? Nothing. High jinks, nothing more. I can't deny that we did things. Irresponsible things.
Like what? Ren said.
God, I don't know. Smashed some glass, made some noise, bought some Charlie.
That's it, Ren said.
Petty vandalism and recreational drugs.
Come on.
Khan shot her a wary look. But none of it was at our instigation, and all of it was done in a spirit of experimentation and adventure.
He seemed to stop himself, and then clenched his teeth.
We fell under his spell, you see.
You mean Peregrine War? He was your housemaster 20 years ago, wasn't he?
Khan shook his head. I mean the master's favourite.
He laughed.
I mean Peregrine's representative on Earth.
And I suddenly saw who had the most to lose.
You're talking about Ben King, aren't you? Was he the master's favourite?
He couldn't look at me.
I didn't say that, he said. I didn't give you any names.
He gripped a fistful of his hair.
You're meant to be here to help me.
Would you like to make a statement? I said.
Khan's mouth twisted into a grotesque parody of coquettishness.
Would you like me to, detective?
I think you're ready to talk to us, Mr. Khan, I said. I think you know that it's really the only option you have left. I looked around at all the useless luxury. This is no life, is it?
He sucked hungrily on his cigarette. I need to talk to a few people. I need to talk to my wife. My beautiful...
He choked up, hung his head, then gathered himself.
And my lawyer, and my children, God help me. After that, I'll come to your station.
He was starting to compose himself now.
I believe there's a possibility that I can help you with your
inquiries. And when will that be? Ren
asked. When I am fucking ready, young
lady. I shook my
head. Not good enough, sir, I said. And watch your mouth when you're addressing my
colleague. We have reason to believe that a serious crime was committed during the period when you were a student at Potter's Field. I could take you in now if I wanted
to. He laughed. Really?
And by this time next year, you would be waiting outside in your new security guard's uniform, watching over my children as they unload their mountain bikes from my wife's Porsche Cayenne. Wouldn't you?
He paused, took a breath. Tomorrow morning, he said, afternoon at the latest. I promise. I want it to be over.
It will be, I assured him. We can help you, but you have to help us.
What happened at that school? What happened? I'll tell you what happened. They break you down, and then they build you up. That's what they do at those fine old English schools. That's what your parents are paying them for. They take you apart bit by bit, and they put you together again in their image. They take scared little boys, and they turn them into captains of industry, leaders of the land, future prime ministers.
He took a long pull on his cigarette.
The first day I met Peregrine War, I was 13 years old. He was just an English master. He drew a single chalk mark on the wall just above the blackboard. That is Shakespeare, he said. And then he drew another chalk mark at the very top of the blackboard. That is T.E. Lawrence. And then he got down on his knees. We were all laughing madly, of course. And drew a third chalk mark just above the floorboards. And that is you.
Salman Khan smiled a crooked smile as he waved his cigarette.
And we took it from there.
It was a busy morning at the Black Museum. A dozen young cadets in uniform were squeezed into room 101. Sergeant John Kane contemplated them without pleasure or pity.
Ground rules, he said. You do not touch anything. You do not photograph anything. You do not take a souvenir that you think nobody will miss. Believe me, I will miss it. Everything here is far older and far more valuable than you are.
A few guffaws, but Sergeant Kane wasn't laughing.
So show respect, he continued, and keep your sticky paws in your pockets at all times. He unlocked the door to the Black Museum. Go on, off you go. They set off, excited and laughing, like big kids on a school trip. When the last of them had shuffled into the first room, the one mocked up to look like the original museum in Whitehall, Sergeant Kane turned his attention to me. They've come down from Endon, he said. This spotty shower are coming to the end of their course and sending them to me as an attempt to prepare them for the real world. A new initiative. I'll wait, if that's okay. He nodded. Best to wait. Join them, if you like. I followed them through into the Victorian sitting room. 9 young men and 3 young women who were happy to be on a field trip, snickering at the fake fireplace and fake sash window. They passed under the hangman's noose and reached the table covered with weapons. Shotguns and rifles, replicas and a real thing, walking sticks that were really swords, umbrellas that were really handguns, and a glass case full of automatic weapons. By the time they went through the doorless opening into the museum proper, their laughter had stopped. They saw the walking stick that turned into a sword, that then turned into a knife, the cop killer. There was every kind of gun, every kind of knife, some of them dark with prehistoric blood. They paused longest before the display about the officers of the Metropolitan Police who had been killed in the line of duty. By the end of their visit, and it doesn't take very long to see the Black Museum, they were silent and shaken. This place is a learning centre, Sergeant Kane told them, leaning against his cluttered desk and holding a mug that said, Best Dad in the World. I hope the lesson that you have learned today is that there are many ways to kill a policeman. They said nothing. Thank you for visiting the Crime Museum at New Scotland Yard, Kane concluded with a formality I had not heard before. Before you graduate from Hendon, I suggest you go to your school's Simpson Hall, where you will find the Metropolitan Police Book of Remembrance. Her Majesty the Queen has signed it, and, before your studies come to an end, so should you. He looked at their serious young faces and nodded once. Take care of yourself, and take care of each other. Thank you. Good luck, and goodbye. When we were alone, I opened my kit bag. Inside was a large evidence bag containing the Kevlar Stealth that had been worn by DCI Mallory on the night he died. It was almost new apart from the large stain on the right shoulder from the neck wound that had killed him. Handling it with great care, I entrusted it to the safekeeping of Sergeant John Kane of the Black Museum, New Scotland Yard. Chapter 31. Stan's favourite cafe in Regent's Park was the Honest Sausage, just off the boardwalk near London Zoo. We were at an outside table sharing a bacon sandwich, my dog on my lap, when she walked in. Sooner or later, every dog person in central London walks into the Honest Sausage. You again, Natasha said. She didn't sit down. Susan and Stan did the dog dance, moving in tight, excited circles as they sniffed each other's rear end. Then the Pekingese Chihuahua Cross had suddenly had enough and turned and yapped in his face. Stan backed off immediately, tail between his legs, edging closer to me for protection. Fancy bumping into you, Natasha said. What's the lovely old English saying? Accidentally on purpose. Hello, Stan. At least she was pleased to see my dog. It's a good saying, I said. I went to your old apartment block, but they said you had moved. Just across the park. Marylebone. I downsized. I held out the manila envelope to her. Your videotape. I wanted to return it. She took it from me without speaking, her mouth tightening. She still hadn't sat down. She wasn't going to now. Not with the videotape of that old rugby match in her hand. I also wanted to say that you were right and I was wrong, about how your late husband lost his eye. I was rough and rude, and I'm sorry. I really am. I shrugged. That's it.
And what did you think might happen? Did you think you were going to return my VHS tape and say sorry, and then I would take you home with me and have wild sex?
Well, I said, it crossed my mind.
She shook her head.
We missed our moment, she said.
I was surprised how sad that made me.
Did we really?
Yes. Men and women have a moment and sometimes they just miss it. Bad timing.
Like missing a flight.
Exactly like missing a flight.
My phone was in front of me on the table. It began to vibrate. Wren calling, it said.
Natasha laughed. We don't even know each other.
I know you, I said. You're one of those party girls with a good heart who wants to settle down but chooses the wrong man, and then it all falls to pieces. You can see yourself getting harder and more cynical, and you don't like it because you're expecting a better life. Stop me if I'm getting warm.
My phone was still vibrating.
Story of my life, Natasha said. But what kind of man are you? Are you one of those men who stop looking at a woman so he can look at his little phone?
The world is full of those men. That's not what I want.
No, I said. That's not me.
I can't stand guys like that.
I'm actually thinking of getting rid of this phone.
Wren calling. But you know what? I do have to take this call.
Of course you do.
Natasha scooped up her Pekingese Chihuahua cross and walked away on those long legs. Without turning round, she raised one hand in farewell. I picked up the phone.
Whitestone heard from Salman Khan's lawyer, Wren told me.
Khan's not coming in.
He's not coming in today.
I could hear her breathing.
Max,
Khan's never coming in.
Salman Khan's beautiful home had burned for most of the night, and the wealthy street stank of smoke and death. A body had been recovered and taken away before I arrived. Where the house had stood on the leafy St. John's Wood Avenue, there was now a blackened husk, sodden and steaming. A £5 million monument to ruin. The great pyre had collapsed in on itself at some point, taking the roof with it, and among the wreckage you could just make out what had once been the subterranean swimming pool, now heaped with collapsed brick, bent steel, burned wood. Fire officer Mike Truman stood between two fire engines and watched his men carefully picking their way through the ruin. D.I. Gain and I were with him. Gain taking notes, while beyond the police tape, uniformed officers kept back a small crowd wielding camera phones. They seemed to be mostly hired help, walking dogs to the park or children to school.
You didn't see the locals walking about round here.
There's evidence of some kind of accelerant, Truman said. A petroleum distillate like diesel fuel or gasoline. But we also found a small motorbike, a child's motorbike, if you can believe that, at the foot of the staircase, so that could explain the traces of accelerant.
Gain said, that's the fire's point of origin.
Truman nodded. Looks like it.
But how did he die? I said.
You mean, was it the fire or the smoke that killed him?
Gain was staring at me.
No. DC Wolf's asking, did someone cut his throat?
I had never seen a burned corpse before. I had never seen how death by fire seems to coat a body in a black substance that comes from the very centre of the earth. I had never experienced the double shock of seeing what a fire takes away and what it leaves behind. Every inch of living flesh on Salman Khan's body had been replaced by something that resembled a rough black overcoat. Yet, you could clearly see his ribcage, his teeth, and the fine bones of his hands, the fingers now long and tapered with all the flesh burned away, like the fingers of a concert pianist. The fire took away everything but left the shadow of some unimaginable pain. His mouth was open, as if crying out in agony, and his elegant hands were placed over his heart and genitalia, as if protecting himself in the last instant of life. Whitestone and I were in a viewing room at the Ian West Forensic Suite, watching on CCTV as Elsa Olsen
examined Khan's charred remains. "Did you ever see pictures of Pompeii?" Whitestone said, more to herself than to me. "They look like they're screaming, don't they?"
"They look like they're going to be screaming forever."
"He was going to come in," I said. "He was going to make a statement."
Whitestone looked at me and shook her head. "Mr. Khan agreed to be interviewed in the presence of his lawyer," she said. "That's all."
"But how did he die?"
Whitestone gestured angrily at the screen. "How do you think he died? He died in the fire." Then I was through the door and into the mortuary, and Elsa Olsen was looking up from the burned cadaver on the stainless steel slab before her.
"Scrubs and hairnets, Wolf. You know that."
"How did he die, Elsa?"
Whitestone was right behind me.
"How did he die, Elsa?" I said again. "Was it like the rest of them? Did someone cut his throat?"
"DC Wolf," Whitestone said calmly, "get out of here."
I ignored her.
"Elsa, you have 20 years of experience. You're in a million-pound state-of-the-art mortuary. You must know how he died."
Whitestone gripped my shoulder, hard enough to turn me around. How could such a slight woman summon up such reserves of physical strength? There was a rage in Whitestone, and she let me glimpse it now.
"You think someone cut his carotid arteries, don't you, Max?" she said. "You think someone stuck a commando dagger in his neck and then torched the house. You think our killer is still out there."
"That's exactly what I think."
Whitestone gestured at the blackened corpse.
"But why would they bother? I mean, really, look at the state of him. Why would anyone bother cutting the poor bastard's throat?"
"Because he wouldn't commit murder with fire," I said. "Too unpredictable."
"Why is this murder?" "I saw TDC Wren's report. I've spoken to Gain and Fire Officer Truman. A rich, chain-smoking drunk drops a cigarette butt near a fuel tank. The next thing you know, smoked salmon. Why exactly does that surprise you?"
"Do you know what oxidation is, Max?" Elsa said gently. "It's what fire does. It's what fire is. Oxidation is what happens when a fuel substance combines with oxygen to produce light and heat. It's what makes fire a living, destructive entity."
She looked at the burned piece of meat on the stainless steel slab.
"There's no evidence that someone cut his throat, because fire destroys everything."
At the Cromwell Green entrance to the Palace of Westminster, I showed them my warrant card. I kept it in my hand as I went through the security turnstiles. Big Ben ringing in the sky high above. Then passed the armed officers in twos and fours, cradling their Heckler and Koch assault rifles, and finally through the search point just before you enter the great expanse of Westminster Hall. Under the hammer-beam roof, the thousand-year-old hall teemed with life. Guides and tourist groups, journalists and lobbyists, MPs and their constituents. I walked quickly past them all and up the stairs at the far end, where a security guard stopped me under the great medieval window that spilled winter light into the hall. I showed him my warrant card too and told him that I was here to see the MP for Hillingdon North.
"And is Mr. King expecting you, sir?"
"Probably." He hesitated for just a moment.
"Central lobby, sir."
I turned left and walked down to the central lobby, where great prime ministers get full-size statues and mediocre prime ministers get life-sized busts. I spoke to the doorkeeper, and he went off to find the MP for Hillingdon North. He came back with a cool blonde in glasses and a business suit.
"DC Wolf, I'm Siri Voss, Mr. King's PA."
Just the hint of a Scandinavian accent. She was the woman who had called King in when we spoke out on the terrace. We shook hands.
"As you can appreciate, this is not a good day."
And then I saw him, coming out of the corridors that led to the House of Commons. Ben King looked at me, white-faced and shaken.
"Detective Wolf," he said, "I thought it was over."
"It's just getting started," I said. "What did you do 20 years ago?" He kept walking, trying to shake me off the way he shook off the world. I fell into step beside him. I could feel the light touch of his blonde PA on my arm,
People were staring at us. Everyone was staring at us. What happened to Anya Bauer? I said. What was Salman Khan going to tell me? What happened at that school? He stopped. A powerful man in his prime, accustomed to being in control but suddenly badly rattled by events. Can we do this some other time? He said. How about when your brother comes back? My brother? You want to talk to my brother? His eyes blazed with something I could not read. I don't think that will be possible. And then he was walking away, and I was suddenly aware of Siri Voss standing right in front of me. Please, she said. Oh, please, leave him. And I saw the two coppers she had brought with her, holding their assault rifles and looking at me with embarrassment more than anything else. It's not over, I shouted at King's back. You know that, don't you? But there was something in the face of Siri Voss that made me let him go. I was at home making scrambled omelette for Scout's tea when DCS Swire called. You're suspended and under investigation by the Police Professional Standards Department pending an IPPC inquiry, the chief super told me. Charges, I said, stirring the eggs. Neglect or failure in duty, oppressive conduct or harassment, whatever sticks. There's already more than enough. A pause. Have you seen the news? You haven't even seen it, have you? You don't even know. Swire sighed with disbelief. Do yourself a favour, Wolf, you dumb bastard. Turn on the TV. She hung up. I served up Scout's scrambled omelette, then turned on the BBC. It looked like the news looked every night. A bomb in Iraq, a riot in Athens, a meeting in Brussels, a missing child, a flatlining economy. And then came photographs of three soldiers. Private Himmel Samir, 22, Corporal Bibek Prabin, 23, and Captain Ned King, 35, of the Royal Gurkha Rifles.
Daddy?
Wait, wait. Let me watch this, Angel. In Helmand, when their armoured vehicle was hit by an improvised explosive device, all three died of their injuries in the hospital at Camp Bastion. The two young Gurkhas wore serious expressions in their official portraits, their features rigid with fierce pride. And there was Ned King, smiling broadly for the camera, as if he held a secret the world could never share.
Chapter 32 Peregrine War walked down Pottersfield High Street. His tremendous height, raising that gaunt, bony head above the crowds, and almost brushing the bunting and Union Jacks that fluttered above the streets. It was just 3 days since the smiling face of Captain Ned King had appeared on the evening news, and now every boy from the old school was there, gathered in their houses, youngest at the front. But the headmaster said not a word to any of them. He did not need to, for he could make a boy straighten his slovenly tie with just his towering presence. He could kill idle chatter with one fierce look. War paused when he reached the boy soldiers of the combined cadet force. 4 lines of them at the end of the high street, self-consciously rigid with military discipline, and for the first time that day, he smiled. The school and the town had turned out for the homecoming of Captain Ned King. I saw Sergeant Lane, the local copper who had been no help with my inquiry about Anya Bauer's disappearance, taking his duties more seriously today. He patrolled down the empty street, closed to traffic for the day, and greeted the headmaster with something like a cringing bow. I glimpsed faces I knew in the crowd. On the far side of the high street I saw Mrs. Jones, the mother of Adam Jones, the second victim, her face skull-like under her headscarf, almost totally consumed by her cancer now, supported by Rosalita, the Filipina housekeeper, who had a protective arm wrapped around her employer. A little further down, I saw Len Zukov standing with Sergeant Tom Monk, the burned features of the physio from Barrington Court making him look like some exotic foreign guest among the uniformly white faces of the Pottersfield townsfolk. Did I see some of them shiver at the sight of the injured soldier? Did I see fathers and mothers,
lift their staring, small children and carry them away to a less disturbing part of the high street. Tom Monk gave no sign that he had noticed. He stared at the empty road, waiting for the homecoming of another soldier. And I saw Natasha, standing alone at the end of the street where the crowds thinned out. Then, all heads turned to watch a lone vehicle coming down the empty high street. Murmurs of resentment. It was a sleek, black Mercedes saloon and not a hearse. Sergeant Lane stepped forward, barking commands at the uniformed officers who stood watch over the docile crowds, holding up one hand, commanding the Mercedes to stop. When it did, a uniformed chauffeur sprang from the driver's seat and opened the rear door. Ben King got out of the car, and the crowd let out an audible gasp at the sight of the MP. He was wearing the jacket his brother had worn on the day he died, a British Army desert camouflage jacket in two colours, swirls of sand and stone, stained with a third colour, a deep, bloody red that was already turning brown. And now I realised that there were cameras for the homecoming. There was TV, press photographers and journalists. I saw Scarlett Bush stick a sharp elbow in a photographer's eye as the media broke through the loose police cordon and spilled onto the street, swarming around Ben King. "Dear Ben," said Peregrine Waugh, suddenly right next to me. "He always was an exhibitionist." "Get them back!" Sergeant Lane was shouting at his officers, red-faced with fury. Ben King walked slowly from the street to the pavement, his face expressionless. His brother's jacket hanging limply on his shoulders and radiating another world of pure horror. Was he wearing the army jacket over a suit and tie? It was impossible to say. All anyone saw was the jacket. He stood in front of the combined cadet force. The young soldiers stared straight ahead, trying not to look at him. Cameras capered before them as young police officers tried to restore order. "Let them see what they have done," murmured Waugh. The words of Jacqueline Kennedy when she refused to change out of the pink Chanel suit that was stained with the blood of her assassinated husband. "Let them see what they have done." Yes, let them see. A scrum was forming on the pavement. Officers had pushed the press back and King's PA, Siri Voss, was handing out a press release. Two journalists walked behind us, each with one of the A4 sheets in their hands. "So it's a British Army DPM desert camouflage jacket," said the first. "Does it say what DPM is?" "Yeah, there, look, disruptive pattern material," said the second. "There's the front page tomorrow, mate." "He should have worn the full kit. Better shot with the full kit." Siri says there was nothing left of the trousers. They were silent for a moment. "God." "Yeah." There were tears now. Some emotional dam had broken in the women and the men of the town, and their children took their cue, confused and upset by the unravelling of the adults. The boys from Potter's Field gritted their teeth, set their jaws and held out for longer. I looked at Peregrine Waugh. The headmaster was dry-eyed. "A terrible day for you, sir," I said. "Ned was a soldier," he said. "I could not wish for a better death for him, only a better war." "When did the first British soldier die in that wretched country?" "1839. "When you're wounded and left on Afghanistan plains, and the women come out to cut up what remains, just roll to your rifle and blow out your brains, and go to your God like a soldier."